You're listening to The World Is Just a Book Away podcast. I'm James Owens, founder and CEO of The World Is Just a Book Away, a nonprofit organization on a mission to promote literacy and education by developing libraries and programs in disadvantaged communities around the world. For more information about The World Is Just a Book Away, please visit www.wijaba.org. That's WIJABA.org. My guest today on The World Is Just a Book Away podcast is Senator Alan K. Simpson. A native of Cody, Wyoming, born into a family dedicated to public service and politics, Senator Simpson served in the United States Senate from 1978 to 1997. Well known for his public service, dedication, and wit, Senator Simpson is author of Right in the Old Gazoo, A Lifetime of Scrapping with the Press. I am also very honored that Senator Simpson is a contributor to my book, The World is Just a Book Away. In my conversation with Senator Simpson, we chat about the importance of reading books, the impact his parents reading to him had on his youth, and the books that have influenced his life. Senator Simpson, thank you for joining us today from Cody, Wyoming. And I was thinking back to when we first met, and actually it was in 2002, 2003. And I'm very honored that you're part of my book that you probably thought I would never finish. Took 15 years. The World Is Just a Book Away. But I did finish it, and I want to thank you for your faith in. You were actually one of the first participants. I can see it went back to February 28th, 2003. So today I'd like to discuss with so that we can hear your thoughts on more thoughts on reading and books with our listeners. And I'd like to start with the simple question of what importance would you say reading plays in your life or has played in your life?
Well, first, I do indeed recall our original gathering and friendship, and that was a very important thing. And I could see that you were involved in a course of action, and I could see, too, that your persistence would lead you to the final result. It didn't matter how long it might take, but I have this book in my hand, squeezed in my hand. Now, I'll get you a picture of me holding it up. Well, literacy, I don't know. I practice law here in Cody and still active lawyer, even though I don't do a great deal, but it'd be 60 years of the law practice this month. And that's quite a record for an old coot, still with a brain. In those years, it was amazing to me how there would be a client, more than one, who would come in with their brother or their wife or some relative and say, you know, I forgot my glasses today. Al, would you have my son read that? And you could tell that they didn't know how to read. And yet people who don't know how to read have an antenna that can lead them into a great other awareness and other gifts of a life. But it's a great hindrance. And in representing people in the criminal practice, most of the ones that were all screwed up were guys who never learned to read. And yet there were also these very successful people who didn't know how to read. Dyslexia is out there, autism, there's all sorts of things now, names and so on, but literacy and learning to read is the key to a better life, a better self-awareness, a better self-esteem, and it's critical. Barbara Bush led the way, bless her soul. It is one of the most important things of life to learn to read, and to do that, you're usually sitting by somebody who you really like, a teacher or your parents, somebody you know or love, and suddenly they're opening a door, and you look at an object with a letter under it, and you say, wait a minute, I know what that is. And so it's an intimate instructional thing, but it's also a critical, important thing in life. Indeed.
And Senator, the way you open your submission in The World is Just a Book Away is, I didn't even really speak until I was 2.5 years old. Hard to believe I know. I didn't have to. My dear brother Pete, 13 months my senior, spoke for me. He would say, Al is hungry, or Al wants to go to bed, or Al wants to get down. And I think that's funny, particularly when you add the hard to believe part. But you go on from there to talk about your mother and father reading to you Treasure Islands, poems from childhood, Sky Island, and the Oz series. What impact do you think that had on you that your parents read to you at that early age?
Well, it was, the intimacy of being, cushioned in their arms or sitting on the edge of your bed, and they're adding their own intonation to the language, where the blind pew said this or something, or the Oz books. Don't forget Billy Whiskers, the goat. Oh, that was something. That was a great little series, unknown to man at the present time. But if you go to the Kennedy Library in Boston, you'll find some of his early objects of learning, and there was Billy Whiskers. I said to my friend Ted, I said, look at that. He said, yeah, we grew up on those. But anyway, I don't know what the hell that has to do with anything. But it's the intimacy of someone and their voice. Usually, then you just go to sleep. They're talking animatedly, or maybe softly, or poetry. Longfellow, my mother loved Longfellow, or Hiawatha, tone poem, poems. Everything, And then you just go to sleep. So you don't forget those things. There's a calmness to it, a very wonderful warmth to it, and it never leaves the inner soul.
And Senator, when we met, and then later when we first met, and then later in the book, The World is Just a Book Away, you actually introduced me to Kipling's poem If, which I want to share with you, has played an important role in my life, and I have it tacked above my desk since that time. Could you talk a little bit about what that poem means to you?
Well, it is something I told my class at Harvard. I know that, James, you're going to be startled at that. I couldn't have got into Harvard if I'd picked the locks. But nevertheless, I taught there for 4 years. It was a wonderful experience. I told them, I said, I've never taught. And they said, yes, but you have something to teach. I said, well, yeah, what? And Marvin Kalb, wonderful friend, he lured me into it. He said, look, you have something to share. And I said, what would it be? He said, well, let's call the course The Creating of Legislation, Congress, and the Press. I said, that's good. We'll do that. So I said, I'll do this only on a couple of conditions. I don't even know what a syllabus is. Somebody will have to help me with that. I don't want anybody messing with my lesson plan, because I don't know what the hell that is, but I will. And there will be no political correctness in my class. We'll discuss everything under the sun with freedom of expression. Nobody left. They said, it's all yours. Do it that way. We had the most fascinating, nobody left, 2 to 4 on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and the kids looked forward to, not kids, they were 21 to 71 in these courses. And so that was a great experience. Now, what the hell, that didn't lead, you were leading me into another thing when I romanced off on that about Harvard. I told the class, I said, now, remember this poem, and remember it every 5 years of your life, read it. Because every 5 years, it will have a different meaning to you, because the lumps of life will have been come to you. And if you can deal with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, or see the things you gave your life to twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, and on, and so they all did. And I didn't test them on it, but I said, just do me the honor of reading it every five. Well, when we left Harvard, they had a special evening for us, and each of my students got up and gave a line of "If." Well, I'll tell you, that was a wonderful evening indeed. But it's all there. There isn't anything left out. You risk everything on one turn of pitch and toss and lose it, and never start at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can walk with crowds, talk with kings, never lose the common touch, all men count with you, but none too much. You know, on and on and on. Keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you. Well, it's and as you go through life, you're going to get some real hits. And when you get those hits, you look at "if" once again, you think, huh, wait a minute. You stoop and build them up with worn-out tools. And then when life, and it says, simply hold on, when there is nothing in you except the will, hold on. Well, enough of that, but you can take shreds of it and pieces of it like Shakespeare and plaster it all over your wall.
And as I said, I did take your advice, and I do have it tacked on my wall, and I read it periodically. It's right in front of my, when I'm facing my,
really?
It's right in front of me. Yes, it had that impact on me.
That's a very lovely thing. I didn't know that, but I'm quite moved by that. Because it's all there. It really is. And he must have been quite a guy. I've read other things of Kipling. He's a tough one, you know. They were hanging Danny Deaver in the morning. Well, maybe that was Service. I never can keep up. Robert Service, Kipling, they're all jumbled up in there, but God, it's fun.
Senator, aside from if, the poem by Kipling, what other book would you say, or books, have most influenced you, or would you encourage people to read, particularly now in this age of immediacy and all the technology where we have access to?
Well, oddly enough, I do read, and I love to read, but I can't really grasp the new literature about where we are, the electronic age, the waves, and I'm not talking about Steve Case. I think he's a tremendous author, but I'm talking about those books are a little beyond me because I don't have the comprehension of the electronic world. I mean, I can't. Somebody handed me something the other day, and I said, "What's that?" And he said, "It's a flash stick." I said, "I remember that from Flash Gordon. I used to read Flash Gordon, Dr. Hugo, Wilma. They were talking about flash sticks, which were guns, of course. But I find a great admiration for those who write it. But I am at the age of life where I know that I'm not one of those who totally comprehend it. And so I avoid them. And there are new methods of government. Yet Erskine Bowles and I did a 67-page report on the debt and the deficit, but we used words like going broke and shared sacrifice, which we still think are used in the vernacular of the day, but, I mean, this is madness. Forget who's Trump or forget Elizabeth Warren, whoever you want to hate, or Hillary, and there's a lot of that stuff going on. And then the freedom of writing and the First Amendment is leading us to sewage pit. It was Justice Jackson, you know, decades ago, said the Constitution is not a suicide pact. But there's so much stuff now that is very troubling, and it all comes from this weird world. Now Facebook and Google are getting hammered flat. I mean, they peddled all this stuff, and what for? Money. Mm. Money. That's no other purpose. The filthy pelf. Well, enough of that. You're thinking, there's that old fart. He really got going there. And no, but I tell you, reading today, you got to go back to the classics. But who wants to do that? I just picked up a copy of, certainly not an original, of Hiawatha, with illustrations by Frederick Remington, the great artist. Thought I'd pitch into there again. I have stuff laying around where I've maybe gone 10 pages. Lonesome Dove. I knew McMurtry. I knew him. I knew the authors of some of these wonderful books. Jim Michener was a friend. Whenever I held a hearing on immigration, Jim Michener was in the gallery in debate because he said, you know, these things can't go on. It's a sovereign duty of a nation to control its borders. Doesn't mean that you're xenophobic or you know, all the rest of the things go with it. He stayed in our home. We stayed in his, in the Eastern Shore. And George Bush has known him for 50 years. I enjoy what Meacham has done and the son, George W., writing about his father, or people I know that I, Kay Graham was a lovely friend when we were in Washington, and her book. So I do look at those, but I don't spend a lot of time in gymnastics of the mind. I like clarity. I like understanding. I like a force. I like a feeling that I can share through a book. But I don't. I'm not into some of the great treatises of the day that you read about in the back of the New York Times. It was always good in Washington when you go to a dinner party and you knew that somebody next to you would say, what are you reading now? What is your particular interest? So you'd just go to the book review before you went to the dinner and, oh, my, isn't that wonderful? That poor Claude from Wyoming has read that. There's a lot of snob stuff connected with, you know, quote, what are you reading? Unfortunately, I don't think Trump reads anything, but that's another story. I think he's dyslexic. I really think he has difficulty reading. I don't think he reads memos. That's just a personal view based on a personal friend of his telling me that very thing. Well, enough of that. Don't want to get off into politics, but books. When I was a young lawyer, I read The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit. Everybody was supposed to have a martini at lunch. Hell, I tried that for 2 weeks and fell asleep in front of my clients. I thought, I'll be out of business here soon. And then, of course, Advise and Consent. I did know Alan Drury. I came to know him in Washington. That book made a great impact because I knew I was going to be in politics, Advise and Consent. The Last Hurrah. Those were great political books, but fun. The lives of people I knew.
Senator, can you think of something or any book or a couple books you would recommend to millennials to sort of, you said go back to the classics that you would for particularly this younger generation who has so much exposure to so much information, something that's, from a different perspective, perhaps a different time that you think it's helpful to go back and read or would be interesting for them to read?
I don't know. I don't have any commanding feature that veils my mind about a book or several books that, quote, changed my life. They all had an influence in my life, but I don't wake up at night thinking of a book that had that impact. Poetry, Shakespeare. You don't need much more. If you were telling a young person what to get involved in, try Shakespeare. Mm. It's been around for about 400 plus years. Why? Because it's about love and hate and lust and deceit and cheating and stealing and war and hate and jealousy. What the hell? And if you have a girlfriend that suddenly you see dancing with some other screwball at night while you're out boogieing around and you're jealous, well, go read Othello one more time. Because what he did to his beautiful Desdemona when he smothered her to death because he was filled with jealousy and hatred, all inspired by Iago, the evil little bastard. So you can do Macbeth, you can do As You Like It. There's a particular phrase in As You Like It has great meaning to me. It's called, "What he has scanted men in hair, he hath given them in wit." You to think about that a while. And then, of course, Hamlet. I mean, if you really wanted to do the deep mining of books and tragedy and plays and lightness of spirit, go to Shakespeare. And that one, you'll be safe. You can say, what books do you like? Oh, I don't know. What do you got in mind? Well, pick one. You know, any kind of thing within Shakespeare. Lear, you know, how sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child. Another great little message I tell when I was practicing law, don't forget that great phrase, ingratitude, thou marble-hearted fiend, and when found in the heart of a child more hideous than a sea monster. I love that crap.
And I think it's a very sage advice, and even thinking myself of how long it's been since I've spent some time with Shakespeare, that it's very helpful to and insightful to go back to the great classics.
Well, that's certainly it is for me, James. And as I say, there isn't anything that comes up in your life that you know, a failed business deal, whatever, disappointment, either, just say, well, wait a minute, what did the bard have to say about that, about beauty and love and you know, all those things. And so I have snippets of all this stuff in my head, but it all comes to pass. And then I pick one up and I'll do something which I think is lost on the young people, is committing. The teacher would say, I want you to commit this to memory. It meant learn this, baby. We had to learn the Gettysburg Address and recite it. We had to learn, poetry and recite it. And so I have this, even at the tender age of 87, September 2nd, I like to learn a little great new phrase. Okay, honey, that's this woman I've been living with. There she goes out the door. She said hello.
Please say hi to
there was somebody was talking about the meteor shower, which was a couple of weeks ago or something. I missed And I thought, well, wait a minute. Then I remember that phrase from, I think it was Romeo and Juliet. It says, and when he shall die, take him and cut him into little stars, and he shall make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will fall in love with night and pay no promise to the garish sun. Now, you know, when you finish that, you feel cocky. Of course, you're hoping somebody will ask you about it so you can show off. But more than that, you have given yourself some discipline. You have disciplined yourself to, quote, commit that to memory. And that is a lost art, as far as I know. And now you don't need to do that. You just grab your device and dial in something, and then you get the answer without any exercise of your brain, which has now become a flabby little thing at the top of your shoulders because of all that horse shit you go through with the electronic age.
And at the same time, Senator, you have, if I'm correct, three children, six grandchildren, one great-grandchild? Is that correct?
That's correct. So far, you never know in this league. But, yes, that's the present count.
Well, that's
Ann and I have given up that. Ann and I feel we're not fecund any further. Where were we? Yes, go ahead.
So do you spend time, or did you spend time reading to your children and grandchildren?
Sure, but nowadays they're so antsy, you can't nail them down. You know, thank heaven they're all, you know, the youngest, well, the great-grandchild is just about a year and a half. I haven't got my hands on that little gal. That's Isabel. But the youngest of the grandchildren, he's now about 12. And, you know, I would start to read to him about mythology. I like to get to a little Greek mythology, you know, the Minotaur and Medusa. I mean, what can you do about that? And the legend of the Sphinx and the pyramids. And he'd just be kind of looking off like, I got a television set or something to watch. So I found that their attention spans are not like they were when I was reading to our three children from in Poems of My Childhood by Eugene Fields, and Seeing Things at Night was a great one, and you know, Just Before Christmas, I'm As Good as Cat Can Be, and all these books of children's books, and Treasure Island, and things illustrated by N.C. Wyeth, and King Arthur, and our kids love that, but you know, or The Wind and the Willows, so I could play that I was Mr. Toad. Oh, Toady, he'd ratty and moly down by the river, and he saw the yellow motor car, and he said, ah, a motor car, and I'd make all these noises. And I think, my God, he's gone goofy in there, but kids love that. And I think now they think, you know, they're into other things of stimulation that don't have anything little to do with true imagination.
Do you think then there's maybe what's the point of reading to them, or do you think it's more important to try to stimulate that in whatever way we can?
Well, I think it's important to read. I mean, they'd sit there and I'd say, come back here, Aiden, and I'm not through with this, and you rascal. And he'd say, okay, Granddad. So, you know, and then you read to them about the children's hour and how they came creeping over their dad's shoulder and how he said, I'm going to lock you in the dungeon of my heart forever. You can read that stuff to them and almost get teary about your love for grandchildren and children. They see that. They see if you're moved. They can spot that in a second. That's one thing they have, an antenna, a tear coming to your eye as you're reading about something which is so profound and yet so good. You never want to quit doing it, and I don't. And in fact, they'll come by and I'll say, what are you reading? And this youngest of the grandchildren, he wins awards. He reads, he's a voracious reader, and he wins his sixth grade class. They hand him a big certificate for having read 23 books, whatever it is, and he knows what's in them. So I think that's great. I don't know what's in them, but his parents know what's in them. So, yeah, you don't ever quit that. No, you never want to quit that.
Sorry, Senator, go ahead.
Oh, don't be sorry. I I could talk a long time, James. You know that.
Well,
now, go ahead.
Say because it links to something that really stood out to me in your passage in The World Is Just a Book Away, on page 205. It's the paragraph that begins with "If you are only interested" and ends with "Marvelous Wizard." And I'm wondering if you could read that paragraph to us.
Well, you intrepid rascal, you've warned me about this. And so I turn to that. I have this book in my hand with this nice plastic cover, and there's my picture threaded out there, very close to Lauren Bacall, which, of course, is good because she became a nice friend. Finally, Anne said, if you're going to go to another play of Lawrence Bacall and go backstage, I don't know what will become of you. Anyway, nothing happened. But she was really a charming woman. She really was, and Julie Harris. Okay.
Before you read that, Senator, because you touched on Ms. Bacall, I don't know if you remember this anecdote, but it was something that's... I got a message from you one day, and you said... you said, Jim, you called me Jim at that time. Jim, I realized I've lost Betty Bacall's number, and I'm wondering if you could send it to me because I'd like to send her a message. Yeah, I don't know if you remember that.
I do.
And I thought my life has really taken a very interesting turn when Senator Al Simpson is calling me to get Lauren Bacall's telephone number.
Well, I did get it, and then saw her one night at the Kennedy Center. And then, of course, she did a play with Julie Harris in Boston while we were there. And we slipped down to, the, I think, Sullivan Street Playhouse. And that was another great evening. And then she just quit. She said, I've had it. I don't want to do any more of this. Well, you probably want me to read this damn thing,
yes,
don't you?
Yes.
Okay. It says, if you are only interested in the life of politics, it's a barbaric existence. I also need art, music, and books. Sometimes in a deadly hearing or a day of absolute stupefying details, I would imagine myself fishing on our beloved Bobcat Ranch, like James Thurber's Walter Mitty, who can imagine himself a great surgeon while sitting quietly in a car waiting for his wife. Imagination clears the mind. It gives me the power to look at something and wonder what it does, where it came from, how it flies, or how it functions. I can't invent anything. Hell, I can't even drive a nail. But imagination helps me to think I'm a wizard, a marvelous wizard. And to this day, when I see a Maxfield Parrish or an N.C. Wyeth painting, I'm transported back to those pleasant times of cozying up to my mother and father as they read to my dear brother and me. Those are fuzzy, tender memories, and I'm very lucky to have them down inside to carry with me through life. Reading did that.
Beautiful. And I think you're highlighting the importance of reading and the development of the imagination of children and how we use it as adults is a very important point. I want to go there, Senator, because of our limited time. I want to touch on something else, because one of the things that struck me when you and I have talked over the years is that you described that the tone of the way things are done in Washington changed dramatically from your years of service, from I believe it's 1978 to 1997. And earlier you said my friend Ted, and I want to say for the listeners, you're referring to Senator Ted Kennedy. And it struck me that you were from different parties, but you shared with me that you were very good friends. And Senator Kennedy is in this book, as you know, but obviously has passed away, and I can't interview him. So I wonder if you could just touch on that the change in the tone of how people are communicating? And then secondly, if anything you would know about the importance of reading in books in Senator Kennedy's life?
Well, it was very important in his life. He was well-read as a boy because of his mother and father and his brother. I mean, that their lives were filled with books, and I don't know what all kinds, but I know that Ted enjoyed them. But no, when I went to the Senate, my father had served with Ted. My dad was in the U.S. Senate, and when he went in 1962, he was he was a senior member over Ted by one or two, whatever they had the numbers of seniority. And Dad said, "Now, Al, when you get to Washington, get to know that kid, Ted. He caused his parents as much pain as you've caused your mother and me." Well, I said, "Now, Dad, you don't mean that." Well, he didn't. But anyway, he liked Ted Kennedy. He said, "Hell, we don't agree on things." So I got to know him, and we didn't agree, but we enjoyed each other's company. And then his wife, Vicky, was very much involved with the lab school, which was very interesting, progressive learning kind of, you know, for kids who don't learn normally, but sure as hell are normal kids once they have the method of learning that excites them. And then, of course, we did a radio program for 8 years. That's where you get to know somebody. It was called Face Off. 5 days a week, 2 minutes each of us blast away on each other, and then a rebuttal. And we did that thing for 8 years. Went Armed Forces Radio, went all over Mutual Radio. So that was fun. And we'd get on the Senate floor and say, "Oh, God, you really rammed it to me there the other day." I said, "You deserved it. There's no question about it." And he'd say, "Well, I got one for you next week." And then he'd hammer me flat. And then we'd have legislation. I'd say, "Now, are you with me or not?" And he'd say, "Look, I'm not. But I could make this suggestion to you." Or he'd come to me and I'd say, "I can't be with you on that, but if you really want me on the board that, then here's a suggestion I would make to you. You make that change or this amendment, I could get a board." So that's the way we used to work. Nowadays, you don't even talk to each other. You don't even talk to people in your own party. Hell, Schumer can't keep track of his troops any more than McConnell can of his. So they just hammer themselves away and do it with great brutality and powerful. You know, I know every word George Carlin rolled out. I can do them all. I can do some he even forgot. But it won't endear you to the general public. And yet, I found it helpful in sometimes negotiation where you just finally just say, "Wait a minute. Let's get down to this. You know, what the hell are you really doing? You're just full of crap as a turkey, and let's get on with it." But that's something unwritten and needs to be done with great pungency and Anglo-Saxon words that are quite distinctive. But enough of that. But nowadays, it's savagery. And nowadays, it's a lot different. There's not disgust or disappointment. It's called hate. I hate Chuck Schumer. I hate McConnell. So you have a session on civility. We've done that. I'm on that advisory board down in Arizona, honoring the dear congresswoman who was shot. She's amazing, resilient. And they'll say, "We need to have civility, and we must do this." So we'll have a session on civility. And so you get into, and everybody's, you know, you button your shirt, your heart fell out, and you feel good. And then someone will mention Donald Trump. And they say, "But wait a minute, we're not talking about that son of a bitch. That's a different matter. He's a psychopath, you see, and so he isn't." Oh, I'm sorry. And then they'll mention Elizabeth Warren. "Oh, Pocahontas, yeah, the gal who pretended she was Indian and she wasn't at all. It's like Ward Churchill at CU." And the fight is on. And that's the way this baby is working now. And it's deep in the wormwood, I can tell you, and it's called hatred. I hate Hillary. I hate Trump. I hate this guy. I hate this guy. I hate Democrats. I hate Republicans. It's tough to watch, because and then you have your relationships with people on the other side. I used to go into the Senate because I wasn't lobbying for anything. And remember, I went over to Dale Bumpers, who I thoroughly enjoyed, Democrat in Arkansas, great storyteller. He was as full of crap as I am, and we just laugh and hug each other. And as I finished that greeting, one of the senators, Republicans, said, "What were you doing over there?" Well, I said, "Just talking with my old pal Bumpers. We had a lot of fun when I was in the Senate." And he said, "Well, you don't want to talk to him. He's a real lib. He's the guy that tried to save Clinton, you know. You know that, don't you?" I said, "I don't give a shit. Go back into your hole and get out of my life. I don't need that." I mean, these guys are pinheads. They live that way, all pinched up. And they usually smell bad. They got BO and heartburn and gas. Show me a 100%er and I'll show you a guy you want to stay away from. They're called seethers. I prefer to be with the seekers instead of the seethers.
And what can we encourage people to do then? You mentioned that hatred coming out in a session on civility. What can we encourage young people or people in general to do in terms of communication?
I don't know. It's going to all happen at the ballot box, I guess. That's no other place for it to happen. And that's going to go on that's going to go on in November. There'll be elections, and then they'll elect somebody that I don't know. But you can't. What do you tell young people? They're not listening to older people. They think you're a crusty old fart, and you are. You're a little cranky, and you don't have the patience you did before. What you tell them is, how would you like to have someone, the dirtiest four-letter word in the alphabet is pity. How would you like to have people feel pity for you? Well, I wouldn't, nor would anybody else. So, I mean, you pull off enough crap and you become an object of ridicule and pity. And I say, if you like that feeling, well, then I'm sure you're not eating a full breakfast and probably drinking too much and smoking too much and maybe even giving up on the old green stuff and going to something heavier so you can deal with life. Well, life, it's like Ann Landers used to write. She said, I drank to drown my sorrow. And they said, well, but sorrow floats. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with booze and drugs and all the rest of it. These young people, they don't like pain. They don't want to have any nasty thought. That's what political correctness is, just like wearing duct tape over your mouth. Say that you've never had a bad feeling about somebody, never had a bias or a prejudice. Give me a break. Make you puke. Of course you have. But then as a civilized person, you put it aside and move on. You don't dampen it with, you know, some nice thing that makes you feel good and it's chewy and you can sit by the fire and play the guitar and play footsie. You know, life ain't that way.
Absolutely. Senator, is there anything, any other final thoughts you'd like to add about books, reading, or life in general?
Well, life is a joy, and the beauty of life is all around us. And of course, I live in Wyoming, but there's beauty anywhere. Campuses, where you are, California, beautiful state, you know, tragically on fire.
Thank you, Senator. I every time we talk, I learn something from you and from your thoughts, and I want to encourage our listeners to, if they'd like to learn more about Senator Simpson, to look at his book, read his book, Right in the Old Gazoo, A Lifetime of Scrapping with the Press, more recent biography entitled Shooting from the Lip, The Life of Senator Al Simpson. Senator, I'd like to thank you for your lifetime of service to this country, and I'd like to thank you for having faith in The World is Just a Book Away and being such an early participant in helping us promote children's literacy. And I'd like to thank you for your friendship and for participating in the podcast today.
Well, I'm sitting right here in my den with that beautiful picture of Anne, which you were with us the morning that was taken in your presence, beautiful black and white. And I think of the kindness that you shared with us, and Anne and I appreciate it, but I guess I really have a big, thing on the top of my head about you, and that's persistence. And you are a persistent man. You knew you were going to give birth to this. You did, and you haven't let it go. And with it, you've established these libraries and things for other people around the world. It's quite amazing. And you remind me of my grandfather. He said that doesn't matter how. He said your good is the world. It does, if you can do all things for good, if you don't care who gets the credit. I've never seen you guy out reaching for credit, not money, credit, of course, but credit, you know. But this book is lovely. Anne got into it, and she said, these are just some very moving stories here. And they are. It's a beautiful book. Needs to be read. And you need to be heard. And so stay well, and you have a great, great life to savor of influencing other people in the best way.
Thank you, Senator, and thank you for joining us today.
Great pleasure. Good luck.
You've been listening to a podcast production of AW360, the year-round content destination from Advertising Week. Visit AW360 at 360.advertisingweek.com and be sure to check out the other AW360 podcasts now available on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and Stitcher. Producers on this podcast are Jack Hirschman and Richard Larson, with music provided by Audio Network. For more information on Advertising Week, the world's largest gathering of advertising, marketing, and technology leaders, now in 6 markets across the globe, visit www.advertisingweek.com.